Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 34, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. A Louisiana teacher was forcibly removed from a school board meeting. What could have been done differently? One district says it won't get in the way of a student using medical marijuana at school. And we'll tell you the unbelievable reason these children are so excited. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we speak with a history and journalism teacher that's focused on teaching his students how to spot fake news. Hey, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ? Anything exciting up your way?
I'm freezing, Nick.
It is. We're in the deep south, and we are actually snowed in. At least some of us are. Lissa's probably, I guess, is the most snowed in because there's ice all around her house, and I guess you don't really have four-wheel drive, do you, Lissa?
No.
So it's probably best to stay inside. So this is the first time.
Not going anywhere.
This is the first time that we've recorded in 34 episodes that Lissa and I haven't been in the same room. But, you know, the show must go on.
Are you guys having a little separation anxiety?
We are just fine.
No. Nope. we might do this from now on, Nick.
Yes. Other than your voice doesn't sound quite as full with the big microphone, but
thank you.
You know, it is to have a little separation. All righty. So, Lissa, why don't you go ahead and jump into the teacher's lounge? What do you know?
Well, everybody's talking about the Louisiana teacher that was handcuffed and removed from a board meeting last week in Louisiana.
Stop resisting.
I am not. Stop you resisting. Just pushed me to the floor.
Mm-hmm. I think the video went viral.
Right. We're assuming that everyone's seen this video, so.
Probably. Right. So if you haven't, there's plenty out there. It was covered on major news networks, the Today Show, things like that. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about was just kind of like the aftermath of what happened, you know, comments being made. I think it's important to note that Daisha Hargrave was a former Teacher of the Year. She's a fifth and sixth grade language arts teacher that spoke during the open comment section of a superintendent board meeting, basically where they were proposing a pay raise, a $30,000 pay raise for Superintendent Jerome Pio. Mm-hmm. And
it's a Louisiana name, so it can get a little tough.
I'm sure. Yeah,
very Louisiana.
Exactly.
Name.
And so she spoke up, just saying, you know, basically, why are we, you know, giving a pay raise to a superintendent? This would make his salary just under $140,000 a year, when school teachers in Louisiana have not been given a pay raise in almost a decade. So then, you know, we have the school board president, Anthony Fontana, that's asking, you know, her to sit down, and then she was removed. So since then, we do have Superintendent Pio. He did say in an interview that I recently saw that he wishes he had acted differently. He said nothing. He did nothing when she was speaking.
I don't support our people getting arrested. I do not. However, a person has to follow the rules.
You know, you see footage of him taking his glasses off and putting them in his pocket. You know, probably an uncomfortable moment for him, but he kind of let the school board president take over. Mm-hmm. And
Who is his boss, by the way? Like, that's a little bit of a difficult situation.
I think
all
it is
around,
in every district. Yeah, right?
That board is his boss. I mean, right. I have a board I answer to, and they're my bosses, you know?
Right. So he says that he wishes, in hindsight, that he had spoken up and he didn't feel that she should have been removed, whereas the school board president says, no, she wasn't following the rules. We told her that this had nothing to do with the agenda. So then she was asked to sit down and to leave. And when she was asked to leave, you see her reach down and grab her bags and walk out. But then in the hallway is when you see her being handcuffed on the floor, and she's, you know, kind of arguing with the officer that had to remove her. Anyway, I think it's important to note that she, of course, was upset.
And the realization that my students were going to see the video, and that I had to go to work the next day, and I teach fifth and sixth graders, so I wasn't sure how they would feel about it.
So since all this, the superintendent has gone on record saying
she was questioning if you deserve a raise. You know, can't use it's better in the classroom. Can always use more money in the classroom. But when is a good time for a superintendent to get a raise?
And so I'm going to interject here. The teacher pay raise issue is certainly an issue worth discussing. But I guess to me, the whole misstep was just, I've been to a lot of meetings, whether they're, you know, city council meetings or school board meetings. And I think most school board meetings are pretty tame. There's just not a whole lot of, you know, objection at a school board meeting. Every now and then you get a hot topic issue. And it almost was as if this board and the superintendent hadn't thought through, you know, what would I do if things start to get out of hand?
There's a couple of things at play here. One, she spoke to her in public comments, and I believe the board's objection, and again, I'm getting this secondhand. I wasn't there, and I'm not involved, right? So I'm having to glean from different sources on the internet, and inherently there's going to be a little bias all around. So pardon me if somebody feels I get this wrong. But she spoke to her in the open public comments, and you know, you can talk about whatever you want there. You know, she was recognized by the chair, and she spoke, and then she started the chair or the president had a problem when she started asking them questions, and I can understand that you know that's not the purpose of that section. The purpose of the section is for her to make comments, not ask them questions. Mm-hmm. But it was handled completely ham-handedly from that moment on. Like the whole thing is they recognized her once. And then they re-recognized her again, mm-hmm. And asked her, you know, basically allowed her to make more public comments, which was just silly, in my opinion. So I think that it was terribly handled. And frankly, I think that it wasn't the city police. It was what did they call him?
Was it a resource officer or?
No.
Yes.
Was it a resource officer?
I thought he was. I think so. I think he works for the district because that was one of the things
that was
called
a town marshal. Is what it was called, is I believe what his,
okay.
That's his title
Okay, well, I know
was.
He works so with Louisiana the schools.
He may be an SRO. I don't know. Yeah. But here's the thing.
Okay.
That guy completely handled it incorrectly as well.
I think he's very much to blame, but then
I think he has the majority of blame
except
in the situation.
Well, but he's not going to be dismissed. The superintendent said that
not.
He has no plans to dismiss him, that he does not think that he acted out of line in any way. And I will say, even though the superintendent seems apologetic of all the – you know, the kind of sadness and hate and such that has come from all of this.
My sisters, my family, we're all educators. For those threats against them, more people were hurt. It is not fair to our families, anyone's families, anyone in Vermilion Parish.
Anthony Fontana, the school board president, has yet to change his statements. He thinks that she was out of line. He thinks that she didn't play by the rules, and he even made a comment of, you know, what would she do in her classroom if someone stood up and spoke out?
The one thing I would have done differently is just take a recess. Rather, when you have an unruly situation and you don't think you can control it, and the only way you can't control it is with an officer, say, you know what, everybody, we're going to take a recess for 10 minutes, and we'll pick this back up. And that way you can kind of maybe pull the person off to the side and have a reasonable conversation with them. You know, trying to cool things down a little bit. What do you guys think?
I think that the board president, get ready for the beep, Nick, is a horse's ass. That's what I think. Yeah. I think that guy is completely in the wrong. And I think that his attitude is not one of a servant's attitude. This guy's elected by the citizens of that parish to serve on that school board. And I think that he was not serving in the best interest of that school board. I think he let it get personal. And that's the worst thing you could do in one of these meetings. But to me, the two people, if you want to just boil it down, the two people who share the most blame are the board president, like you said, for not his job is to defuse the situation as much as possible. And the worst case scenario possible is a teacher being let out in handcuffs and tears. Mm-hmm. And then the town marshal, why did he think that it's appropriate to drag this woman to the ground and throw her in handcuffs and throw her in the back of a squad car? She was leaving. And even if she wasn't, you could have escorted her off the property and then arrested her if she approached again. It just seemed to me to be very heavy-handed. Mm-hmm. And now everybody that Googles Vermilion Parish, they're not going to see that they're number 6 or 7 in the state. For academics, they're not going to see that, you know, it's a great place to go to school. They're going to see this article each and every time from here on out. Like, their Google foo is gone, right? Like, there's nothing that's going to be positive.
What'd you
Google
say?
Foo, like, they're like, they're Google, I'm trying to think of the word that would be a better word than foo.
No, I like it. Let's go.
Never
with it.
Heard of Google.
But, like, they're Google, like, there's a word for it. It's like pixie dust. Like, they're Google magic. Like, wherever their rankings are on the page are now screwed forever. Yeah, if you search for true. That parish, you're going to come up with, you know, you're going to come up with this story again and again and again forever.
Yeah.
On a personal note, like, the superintendent obviously was very emotional, you know, about this. And it's an embarrassing thing. And no one should have called his family. No one should have called their office and said terrible, threatening, hateful things about it. That is completely 100% wrong. But you're not going to get a lot of pity from the community at large. You're not going to get a lot of pity from teachers either. And what has this done for the morale of that school district?
I feel like, I mean, that's what school board meetings are all about. They're all about, you know, people in the community or people that work for the education system in that area to be able to go and listen and voice concerns. So if those guys sitting up on their podiums weren't prepared to hear somebody voice a concern,
dissent. Yep.
They should have, right, they should have let her voice her concern, which she did so in a non, you know, she wasn't screaming. She raised her hand. Yep. So they should have let her voice it and then and let her speak and then said, "We hear you. We will open that up in another time. Teacher pay raises are long overdue. We are going to open up that issue at another time."
This teacher put her neck out on the line and really drew back a nub. You know, that's effectively what happened. And I think it set their district back in many, many ways. And I think a lot of it's because the board president, again, is a horse's behind and, you know, did not handle the situation correctly. And a lot of this is just because a lot of folks that serve on school boards, they bring you through like a class and that sort of thing, you know, and they say, "Hey, this is how meetings are supposed to work." But most, and like Nick alluded to at the beginning of the show, or outright said, most school board meetings are not like this. Like, you'll have, you know, probably 15 or 16 meetings throughout the year for one reason or another. And the amount of dissent or the amount of it being charged only really happens whenever somebody's getting fired.
Right.
Or they're closing a school or somebody's getting kicked out of school in an executive session. Right.
Right.
Those are the only times that there's any kind of strong dissent. And I think they just handled it very poorly.
All right. Switching gears. Russ, I know you've got a story that's pretty interesting because it looks like there might be a reason to allow drugs into a school.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There was an article that was published in USA Today, got a lot of press in Illinois, but it's about a student that is consuming medical marijuana at school. And this has kind of fallen out. There was a law passed a few years ago in Illinois that allowed medical marijuana, but there was a specific provision in the law that said that the student or the medical marijuana could not be consumed on a school premise. On school premises, excuse me. And so they're in the Schaumburg School District 54. They have such weird names in other states for their school districts. The parents filed a federal lawsuit against this, you know, saying that, hey, this child should be able to consume this cannabinoid on school property. And essentially what's happened is that the Assistant Attorney General for the state, Tom LaPaulo, said, "We are not going to pursue charges against anybody who should administer this or the student or anything like this." So effectively, even though the law in 2014 said that it couldn't be consumed on school property, the Assistant Attorney General for the state of Illinois has said no charges will be more filed. The thing that was astonishing to me in reading this article are two things. One is how huge of a difference. This child has had chronic seizures their entire life. She was diagnosed with leukemia whenever she was 2, and she's had terrible debilitating seizures and brain trauma that she's had ever since then. And basically, it was almost an ongoing thing. And so the last year, the doctors prescribed her a ketogenic diet, which is like high fat, low carb diet. And they also prescribed her these patches. And before anybody's thinking, like, she's not, you know, rolling a joint on campus, right? It's a patch.
I was actually about to ask that question. Like, is there a room to
can she roll a joint with one hand or something? Yeah. No, it's a medical marijuana patch or cannabis oil drops.
Okay.
And cannabis oil drops are actually, in my home state of Mississippi, they're actually now legal. So very, very conservative state.
And we have a congressman, Greg Harper, whose son requires that. And he was actually one of the folks who I think was pushing pretty hard to make sure that was allowed.
But look, since they've been using the patch, she's only suffered one major seizure. And that's a tremendous quality of life difference for that child. And what was really the second thing that was super interesting for all you kind of policy nerds in education is that the family argued that the state's medical marijuana law denied her right under IDEA. It was in her IEP that she would take these cannabis drops and patches. And they basically sued and said that that law violated her rights under IDEA, which is a federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a big, huge, hairy deal. And I thought that was a very unique way, if you put it in her IEP, that she had to receive education in that way. So I think it's a win-win.
So go ahead. Here's my question. So, like, when you have a child that has ADHD and they have to get a dose, you know, after lunchtime or whatever, they go see the school nurse and the school nurse issues that medicine. You have to register that medicine with the school nurse. If you find that medicine in the child's car, you're in trouble. You know, if you find
it's
that
a Schedule II drug in most cases.
Right. If you find it in their backpack, you're in trouble. But if you register it with the school nurse, you're not in trouble. So wouldn't that be the same?
No, because they had a specific provision under state law when they legalized medical marijuana in the state of Illinois. They had a specific provision that said you could not consume it on school property.
So the irony is that, in a way, in the state of Illinois, marijuana is way more legal than, say, an ADHD drug, except on school property, things get a little complicated. That's basically it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a matter of that they specifically, probably well-intentioned, they didn't want people smoking joints on school property. So, you know, they didn't want somebody going to a basketball game or a football game, most likely, and rolling a joint and smoking a joint, even if it was for medical purposes. I think it had, like most things, it had an unintended consequence of banning it on school grounds. So, you know, like Lissa mentioned, it's probably more legal in Illinois to take an amphetamine, which is essentially what doctors prescribe for ADHD, than it is to take this medical marijuana, you know, which is still, you know, illegal under federal law.
Right.
So it's interesting. It was a really interesting article, but it was a good compromise in that effectively it's still illegal.
They're still breaking the law. Right.
Yeah, but you have an assurance that no one's going to come after you.
So. You guys listen to this sound here. Y'all know what that is?
Sounds like cheering to me.
That is a school in Puerto Rico. They had been without power for 112 days, and the power just came back on. And somebody like turned on a cell phone to like start filming what their reaction was.
Oh,
that's incredible.
Gosh.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. And they went back to school after Hurricane Maria, October 10th. And on January 12th, their power was just turned back on. And again, this to me is like the most underreported story in at least the United States.
If this happened in Kentucky,
right,
you would have people, there would be a countdown on the corner of the screen, right, saying 78 days without power in Kentucky. It's like it would be like the oil spill in the Gulf.
Right.
You know, every day they had a crawler. I was crawling, saying how many days it had been.
Right.
The fact that these are American citizens, and regardless of whose fault it is, I'm not even saying it's federal government or the territory's fault. Or I mean, they had huge issues before, right? But the fact that we haven't been able to fix this problem still, and it's still very fragile, is incredibly scary. This is not a foreign country.
No.
This is a U.S. territory. These are U.S. citizens. They have a U.S. passport, and they are treated in this way, and they have to live in a third world country, essentially. That is,
listen, can you imagine teaching for 3 months, more than 3 months without power?
No, I can't imagine, honestly, the depression that would set in among children and teachers, you know, like just a blah funk that nobody can rise above, because so much involves electricity. Like, I can't imagine.
And so much in a community revolves around the schools. I will bring this up as well, since you're kind of talking about that also in my home state of Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi, our capital city, they have great infrastructure issues, mm-hmm. and cold weather has just swept through in the past few weeks. And of course, today it's very, very cold as well, that the school, the Jackson Public School District, has not met since the beginning of the December break, since the Christmas break.
Wait,
so they are,
like,
still not in school.
Public schools have not gone back yet up there?
Nope.
Isn't it a problem with, like, the water lines?
It is. It's a problem of having water pressure. And so the school district has been closed. It's the 17th, and they are still closed. They have not gone back to school. And it's
Baltimore,
not a,
which is so not good issues. Because you run into, you know, then you run into the whole idle minds, you know, with kids not having anywhere to be.
Ooh. Yeah, and then feeding those people. So it's a metro school district. So you can imagine a lot of the kids are not very affluent. And so they receive two of their meals, their breakfast and their lunch at school, and they're not receiving that. And so, you know, you had students, there was an article recently in the paper here that you had students that were walking to soup kitchens because they do not have food at home because they are not getting fed.
Gosh.
It's really, really problematic on multiple levels, and it's not the fault of the school district. It is the fault of the city ultimately, but the current administration wasn't the one who created this problem. This is 40 years of neglect.
Yeah, we've seen reports of pipes freezing in the Jackson area every winter for several years now.
Yeah. Whenever I worked for the State Department of Education previously, there was one year that it got really, really cold. It was the last time it really had a hard freeze like this. Mm-hmm. And there were the porta potties outside of the state capitol,
right,
so that people could use the bathroom because the pipes had frozen and they had burst underneath the building. So anyway, just some food for thought, that infrastructure issues plague this country, they plague our territories, and at the end of the day, they affect students in a huge way.
You know, that video out of Puerto Rico is one of the happiest and saddest videos simultaneously that I've ever seen. Like, yeah. You know, you're extremely happy for these kids, but oh my God, are you kidding me? And again, like, no one was saying they didn't have power for 3 months. Like, you just kind of out of sight, out of mind, and it's really a shame to hear.
Well, I would imagine that a lot of people, like a lot of the reporters, have packed up and gone home.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Do you think NBC, CNN, all those guys, do you think they still have crews there, Nick?
No, I mean, it all comes down to what people are interested in, and it costs a lot of money to put somebody in Puerto Rico, and especially when there's no resources or whatever.
What do you think in a week, if I Google Puerto Rico power or if I Google Kim and Kanye baby, which do you think are going to have the most hits?
You know, it's a really valid point, and it's really sad, and it actually is a good segue into who our guest is going to be for this show, because we're talking to a teacher who, I don't want to say specializes, but he's been working really hard to come up with creative ways to teach his students about fake news and how to identify fake news online, and how important it is to teach, you know, high schoolers or even junior high people of the tons of medium that is out there that can really be confusing for students.
That's great.
Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is a high school history and journalism teacher and the founder of Spin Education. David Cutler authored a column featured on PBS NewsHour called How I Used George Washington to Make Kids Care About Fake News. And he's here to talk to us about teaching media literacy. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm really excited to have you here because you and I kind of have the same background. We both have had this journalistic background, and now we're kind of both working in the world of education. You worked at the Boston Globe for a little bit, and now you're teaching. But you have some pretty interesting perspectives, and you're willing to take head on letting students know about fake news. Am I right?
That's correct. I do the best I can.
It's a tricky subject because, you know, we're in a kind of a hot political climate and what fake news is. How do you really broach this with high schoolers?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's not easy. In fact, yesterday we had a special symposium on journalism. And instead of going to class, students went to different workshops about the field as it is today. And I actually presented on fake news. And to open up my little workshop, I gave students a little fake news quiz to see if they could decipher fake news from real news. And some students got 60%, some 70, and some 80. So it's a real issue. But I think to combat fake news, we need students to realize how easily they can be fooled. So I think that's the first go-to, that it is possible that you are fooled or that you have been fooled in the past.
And so how do you teach them that? Can you kind of give me some of those specific examples of what you were showing them?
Yeah. So I was showing them, for instance, there was this screenshot of a site that looked like it was from ABC News. And students, some students said, oh, that's from ABC. That's credible. But in fact, the logo wasn't exactly the ABC logo. It had been tampered with a bit. And but because they recognized ABC, ABC News, they thought, oh, that's just ABC. And in fact, it was a fake news site designed to look like something credible.
In your opinion, and so listeners understand, because I don't even think everyone always understands, what do you think motivates people to create fake news?
I mean, certainly, there's various reasons. I think, one, people just get kicks out of confusing news consumers, and they just like to go online and cause mayhem for no other reason than they think it's fun. There could be different motives as well, depending on what it is exactly you consider fake news. You know, I consider Alex Jones fake news, pushing conspiracy theories out there. I think he has an agenda. I think he wants people to believe in certain things, like 9/11, for instance, was a conspiracy, or the shooting in Newtown was staged. To me, that's fake. And we need to let students know that they can be fooled. And so to try to combat not just fake news, but also be able to discern credible news from news that's not so credible, they really have to get familiar with the media landscape and not just go to certain sites for information.
So if I'm hearing you right, one possible motivation is going to be political. The other may be just internet trolls, you know, people having fun. I think a third, and this is just my opinion,
sure,
it's money. There actually is a model to make money by creating fake news. What I think a lot of folks don't realize is if you write something completely outrageous and politically, that's something that's going to gain a lot of traction. You know, you're going to go to a website and it's going to be full of ads. And as you click on those ads, if you kind of go down that rabbit hole that we often do on a website, money kicks back to that website. And so it makes sense to write something that is so unbelievable and untrue, but still you click on it.
So I got a story to tell you about that. So over Thanksgiving, I wrote a piece for PBS NewsHour. The headline was, "Teaching Kids About Thanksgiving or Columbus, They Deserve the Real Story." And for that piece, I spoke to different historians, different academics, to really show people that, yeah, these are interesting holidays, that Columbus did a few great things, and yeah, Thanksgiving is a time to get together with family, but these periods also mark some dark times in our past. And I wrote that up. And then a few days after it appeared on PBS, Breitbart News reposted it with a very misleading headline. And the story from Breitbart got tens of thousands of clicks. And I was thinking to myself, man, maybe I should get paid, because that's clickbait. They're changing the headline, changing the story, and people are just responding to that headline without going to the actual source, and that source being my original article. And that's what I always tell students to do. Go to the original source. Go to the source. Don't just believe what someone else is telling you they've heard or read.
I mentioned at the top of this interview, you wrote the article for PBS NewsHour. It's called "How I Use George Washington to Make Kids Care About Fake News." And in that, I was reading through it. You actually mentioned some of the things like check the source and read beyond the headline. But why George Washington? You want to tell that story?
Sure. So at the start of each year with my American history students, I try to get them engaged in thinking about everything they see and hear, including artwork. And so this is, in fact, one of the paintings that I show them. from the German-American painter, whose name I'll probably butcher, but Emanuel Lutz, I think, is his name.
Yeah, and let me pause there. So yeah. I think we all know that painting, like in our mind. Yeah. I'm going to try to illustrate it and try to describe it since we're audio medium here. But yeah. It's that one where George Washington's like standing on the boat and he looks, you know, like this gigantic leader and really prominent. Hopefully everyone kind of can imagine that now. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I asked you, and again, I know I butchered his name. For listeners that know German, I apologize. But he, as you said, he's sitting on the boat, the American flag's in the background. It looks like it's daytime or at least morning. And students, I say to students, okay, here's this picture. What story is it telling? And they tell me exactly what they see, but not what could be false or erroneous about it. Like, does the fact that George Washington is standing while everyone else is sitting, does that raise alarm bells? Or what context do you know coming in that might raise some red flags? And it's always interesting how few students at the start of the year think that way. Think, oh, no, like, I would take this as, you know, being truthful. When the fact of the matter is that, you know, this crossing of the Delaware happened in the middle of a snowstorm. The ships that were used are not depicted in the painting. The flag is a wrong flag. It hadn't been invented yet. And so that really gets kids thinking about what kind of information they're receiving and how they should go about digesting it.
Right. So in other words, fake news has been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Arguably. Yeah.
It's not new. I mean, the term fake news has been popularized by President Trump. But I mean, you go back, I think, to the 1920s or 1930s with Orson Welles going on a radio broadcast, freaking people out by reading excerpts from War of the Worlds. And people thought that was real. And it wasn't real, but people thought that aliens were actually invading. So fake news is nothing new. It's just something that has been, I think, more ingrained in our culture, unfortunately, because of the political climate.
And the other thing that's obviously changed is, you know, we've watched, at one point we had just a few key sources, nationally speaking, that were trusted news sources back in the 50s and the 60s, you know, your major networks, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and so forth. And now we've seen it just open wide up with the World Wide Web, where anyone in a small community or nationally or whatever can say they're a news source and start writing stuff that maybe isn't sourced properly.
I mean, sure. I mean, anyone with a device can now be a reporter. And that's scary. I mean, there are some benefits to that. Yeah. But I think that if you don't have the training or if you're not critical enough of how you're going about the reporting, misinformation can certainly spread. And that's why I think no matter what happens with newspapers, some type of news organization, some type of vetting system will always be necessary.
So you can't put the cat back in the bag now. I mean, that's happening, but you can try to educate our youth. And that's exactly what you're doing. You're on the front lines there trying to let students know that you need to be critical about what you're reading. Tell me this, since you're on the front lines, should we be worried? Do they get it? Like, what is your experience?
Yeah, so, you know, man, it's so tough. I mean, I think some students get it. Some students get it better than others. And the science behind how we should go about teaching students, I should mention, discerning fake news from real news, it's a new science, right? I mean, it's a new field of study. We don't really know all that much yet. And so what I'm trying to do to the best of my ability is just expose students to as many credible sources as I can with the hopes that they'll eventually have their own, for lack of a better term, BS sniffer, mm-hmm. right? That it right. will be somehow caked into them. But there are also other great programs out there. I mean, the News Literacy Project is doing great things as well. And sometimes I have students sign on to that site, and you can actually go through different modules on, let's say, branded contents or spotting fake news or media bias. And this program, which I think is the best I've seen, actually includes interviews with newsroom reporters and editors and they ask you questions and they bring you through guided exercises, which I think has been most helpful for my students so far, at least.
Do you find that teachers are reluctant to want to teach this to students? They just kind of avoid it? Or do you find that they feel like it's their obligation? Where do you think we are there?
Well, I think it depends on the discipline that you're teaching, and also the school type. I teach at a private school, and so I have more latitude to do what I want inside the classroom. Whereas, my peers at public schools might have to get through certain content because that's what they're mandated to do. But as I said, there's no prescription for this. It's really uncharted territory. And the thing that got me really involved with how to help students discern fake from real news actually came out of a 2016 study from Stanford, which I'm sure many listeners are familiar with, that showed that not just middle schoolers or high schoolers, but college students as well at terrific universities can't often discern fake from real or credible from not credible. It's scary. And it's even scarier because there's no prescription to solve this problem.
It is scary. And I think, a lot of us, young people, middle-aged people, older folks, are now getting our news by what bubbles up in their feed. And what I mean by that is what bubbles up in their Facebook feed, their Twitter feed. They aren't necessarily going to the source. So when something becomes important enough, it'll find them. And if you can't discern, which one's the viral fake site and which one's the actual real content, it can be a problem. And you said something interesting. You were talking about how, even college students, roll the clock back 5 years. If we weren't teaching this 5 years ago, that's probably part of the reason that you have the confusion at a college level. And if we aren't teaching it now, roll the clock forward 4 or 5 years and we'll see the same thing. So, should school districts mandate this type of critical thinking in terms of media?
Yeah, look, I wish I had that authority. I would say yes, but it could happen in many different ways. Like, for instance, I know colleagues in private school sectors and public school sectors that are integrating this curriculum into their existing courses. Maybe in some areas you could offer a course just on media literacy. I think that would be fantastic. I think I read an article once that said journalism or intro to journalism should be a mandated course everywhere, maybe even starting in middle school. And I think through that course, you could certainly teach media literacy. I know I do. But it's a tough question.
Well, again, David Cutler, we appreciate all you're doing to kind of educate at least your group of students over there. And hopefully this will inspire other teachers to maybe broach the subject and make sure that students understand the difference between what's real and what's fake in the world of media.
Definitely.
Are you ready for our pop quiz?
Shoot.
All right, here we go. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
I'd have to say, man, I'm going to go with journalism.
All right. I think that's a good one. I have to agree with you, but,
Yep.
All right. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
How to take care of your personal finances.
We've done an episode on that. I think it was 19, but I might be wrong. But, yes. What does every child deserve?
Love.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Information overload.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
A thank you note.
Which teacher changed your life?
Which teacher changed my life? Oh, there have been so many. I have to choose one, huh?
Yeah, we put you on the spot.
Oh, boy. I would have to say the teacher that probably most impacted my thinking and writing was my current colleague, former teacher, history teacher from 11th grade and 12th grade, who really taught me to write and think and be analytical. So I'd have to go with that.
Do you want to say his name?
Sure. Ted Barker Hook.
Good stuff. That's pretty cool that he taught you and now he's a colleague.
Now he's a colleague.
That's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good stuff. And last question, pen or pencil?
Ooh, boy. I would go with pencil.
There you go. All right, David Cutler, again, we appreciate all you're doing for informing the world on fake news.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take care. That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, just leave us a 5-star review and subscribe to the show. And don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.